Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Great to be with you in Boston today, where Penn State will play BC tonight. And the ACC Challenge game at the Conti Forum here at Chestnut Hill. At the Heights. So great to have everybody on board. Lot to talk about in sports. As always, we start with the Kevin Herr memo of the day. Welcome back. Your memo was greatly missed by the audience. We had a lot of reaction.
I'm sure that's not the case, but thank you for the welcome.
Did you quit?
No. I said thank you for the welcome. I said thank you for the welcome.
Nobody could hear you. I know I couldn't.
No, actually, everybody could accept you. I had a button that I needed to push so that you could hear me better.
I see. Well, the Kevin Herr memo of the day. We're going to have Neil Coulong on the show today. Tomorrow, Chris Soleri of the Lansing State Journal in the Big Ten Championship game. And Tony Knopp, the CEO of Spotlight Ticket Management, rejoins the show tomorrow. He has ruined Kevin's fantasy life of what sports happens to be because he's actually introduced the concept of money into sports.
And money was one of the topics on the rundown today.
Well, it's a big topic here. Here it's the primary topic.
I bet it is.
There's two of them. There's 1A, 1B. The 1B is Gronkowski being out for a period of time, and Danny Amendola is still out. They play the Eagles this week, but there's also a feeling here they don't need them against the Eagles, but we'll see. But the David Price signing, which happens to be 7 years, $217 million, but it's not really a 7 year, $217 million deal in reality. The reality is there's an opt out after 3 years. Now, if there's no opt out, then it ends up being 7 years, $217 million, but there's an opt out after 3 years in this contract. The Red Sox there's a reality. They have finished in fact, let me get to all these. Let's do all these and we'll do them in order. We'll talk about the Red Sox situation in a moment. Kevin incorrectly says that CBS Sports reports that the head coach at Michigan will be Michigan defense coordinator DJ Durkin at Maryland. It's actually Pete Thamel of Sports Illustrated who broke the story, not CBSSports.com. It's actually his story. So you have to give credit where credit is really due. And Pete Thamel broke the story on SI that DJ Durkin's going to take over as the head coach at Maryland. Michigan had a great year defensively. I think some people are wondering, after going through a defensive coach with Randy Edsall, did they want another defensive coach? Is this the splash hire that Kevin Plank of Under Armour wanted to make? Or is the division that you have Michigan State, Ohio State, Michigan, and of course we see how Penn State's recruiting, how they're on the move. Did that deter a lot of people saying, I'm not so sure I want to coach in that division? A legitimate question. The other one happens to be with the Tax Slayer Bowl in Jacksonville. The Tax Slayer Bowl in Jacksonville put out a tweet today, and it was put out a little bit before 1 o'clock, and the tweet was a poll question. And the poll question was as follows. Who would you rather see Penn State play in the Tax Slayer Bowl? Georgia or LSU? There is one fly to the ointment. And the fly to the ointment is there is a determining factor, and that determining team is Florida State. Florida State is the number one choice to go there because of how they would bring people in. But there's also here's the other reality. The other reality is, for the Tax Slayer Bowl, could you get Penn State back down the road? And I don't think so. I don't think so. Florida State is an option. So here's how it plays out. On the SEC side, it looks like LSU or Georgia. On the ACC side, they have an option. They say if Florida State is available, they will take Florida State. If Florida State is not available, they will take probably Penn State. All right? And that's from Taxslayer Bowl Administrator Rick Catlett.
It was an interesting tweet to see come out like a few days before you make selections officially.
Well, I think everybody's talking. I mean, they don't just sit there on Sunday and go, hey, okay, what do we do now?
Well, it's been long suspected that Penn State would go to the TaxSlayer.com Bowl.
Yeah, the Gator Bowl. I mean, let's give people an idea of actually where it is. I mean, that TaxSlayer means nothing to anybody. But again, if Florida State is available, that is the number one choice.
Okay, then I'm going to ask the question that everybody else, I think, is thinking right now. If indeed they do go Florida State, where does that put Penn State, in your opinion?
I think it puts them in Nashville.
Okay, well, I don't remember. What's Nashville? I don't remember that one.
That's the Music City.
Okay. Too many bowls, too many cities.
Well, I mean,
too many repeat cities.
One team. Okay, Penn State's one team. You can follow one team, can't you?
Usually, you would think.
I mean, there are three options for Penn State.
Too many repeat cities for these bowl games. You said that a couple of weeks ago.
Well, you know, Orlando has three of them. They shouldn't have three. But that's what it comes down to. And the Jacksonville Sun-Times put out a story today about Florida State, and right now they're ranked number 9. So they feel that right away that rules out for Florida State the Music City, the Belk, and the Pinstripe Bowls, that they would be ruled out because they're number 9 right now in the poll. Okay. So that's where it starts with them, because they are the team that is going to determine whether Penn State's there or not. They might be getting indications from the ACC they're going someplace else. Now, I don't know what that means, but that's what you have to wait and see. Florida State is the team that really, at the moment, determines Penn State's fate as to whether they go to this thing or not.
Well, most of this is in projections that we've been talking about kind of tongue-in-cheek over the last couple of weeks, honestly, have been almost darts at a dartboard, because I've seen Music City Bowl.
Well, this is actually the bowl,
right.
Bowl person saying,
right.
Here are our options.
Well,
now,
and that's what I'm saying.
Here are the three realistic scenarios for Florida State. Number one, they could get into the New Year's Six. They're ranked number 9, you know. They could get into the New Year's Six and play in the Peach Bowl in Atlanta, which would be New Year's Eve at noon. Florida State does have 2 losses, but keep in mind, if Clemson beats North Carolina, that opens the door, I think, for Florida State in Atlanta. If North Carolina wins, then Clemson would take the Peach Bowl spot. Okay? So let's go there. Next, the Fiesta Bowl, which is also a New Year's Six game. But at the same time, the Noles have gone out west, going to the Rose Bowl in 2013 and in the national title game, and then last year they played in the semifinal game. So sending them out west is not completely attractive. And again, part of that does depend on North Carolina and Clemson. Also, there's the Russell Athletic Bowl, which is available December 29th, and the Tax Slayer Bowl. So,
did you mention Foster Farms there? Because that was another
Florida
one I know.
State's not, Florida.
Oh, you're
Florida
talking. State's this is just Florida State. Farms. This is just Florida State. Okay, sorry.
Yeah. I mean, you got to lay out here the Florida State options for everybody, because they are now the ones that are determining your bowl fate. So then you have to logically ask yourself, okay, if Florida State's determining my bowl fate as to whether I go to Jacksonville or not, right, what are Florida State's options? Right? And so you have to answer that question first before you then take it to the next step as to how it affects Penn State. The Gator Bowl has to request a Big Ten team. It's not a question like, take for example, you mentioned Foster Farms. Foster Farms does not have to request a Big Ten team. They get a Big Ten team. They don't have to make a request because they're locked in. They're supposed to take five different Big Ten schools over a six-year span. Okay? Music City in Nashville and Tax Slayer, a.k.a. Gator in Jacksonville, each have agreements that take three Big Ten teams over a six-year span, and they must, under the rule, make a request to the conference to select a team. So they have to put that in. Now you have to figure out, where does Florida State go? If Clemson wins, I think that puts Penn State in Jacksonville, because then Florida State moves up the ladder, and as the number nine team, getting to the Peach Bowl is fine, and it would be a case where North Carolina ends up going to Orlando, or they could go to Nashville, whatever. That's the way it would be. If North Carolina wins, well, Clemson probably would get the Peach Bowl, because it would be their first loss of the year. See, that's where all the – there are a lot of dominoes here, and the dominoes all surround that ACC championship game and not the Big Ten championship game.
You know, when you look at the scenarios that everybody's been talking about, they have – you know, one of them is, let's see, Penn State and Georgia in the Music City Bowl, Penn State and Mississippi State. Another one for the Foster Farms Bowl has Penn State, UCLA, Tax Slayer Bowl. I honestly, and when this tweet came out earlier today, it really kind of hit home, because this is what I've seen a lot of people projecting: Penn State for the Tax Slayer Bowl against LSU, and that was one of the options they had in the tweet earlier today from the bowl people.
Right, and it's the bowl put the tweet out. It's not being put out by anybody else.
Right, this is the bowl people.
But I'm also explaining to everybody that this is far from a, hey, we're going, we're in. That's not the case at the moment. They put the tweet out, and the only two teams they had in there were Penn State versus LSU, Penn State versus Georgia. There was no other option besides Penn State. But there is a reality, and that reality revolves around Florida State. And I think the key is going to be the Clemson-North Carolina game. And if Clemson wins, Florida State has a realistic chance of playing in Atlanta in the Peach Bowl in the New Year's Six game.
Well, I'm going to put you in the Tax Slayer people's seat for a minute, Steve. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm curious about this. Let's say things fall where Florida State is out of the New Year's Day Six game, or the New Year's Eve Six games. Mm-hmm. If you're the TaxSlayer.com people, are you forced to take Florida State, or do you still have the option to go take that Big Ten team if you choose to?
No, you can do whatever you want. You're not forced to do anything.
And see, that's where this is where I thought that tweet was really, really interesting today.
Right, but again, Florida State would be a home team. It would be very attractive to them. And
well, let's face it, how much money can you make on it is the ultimate question here.
Well, I mean, you're not, it's an easy trip from Tallahassee over, so you're not going to have a lot of tourist dollars coming in as to who they face, as opposed to bringing Penn State in there. Penn State hasn't played in Florida in 5 years. Penn State, I mean, a lot of people don't realize that. Penn State has not played in Florida in 5 years. So that comes into play. But Florida State's the key to this. Neil Coulong joins us today to talk about the Steelers. is Antonio Brown still in the league? Is he still? I mean,
far as I know, yeah.
I don't recall seeing much of him on Sunday. We'll come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Sunbury Motors Studio is mobile today in Boston, where tonight we'll have the Big Ten ACC Challenge. Some great games last night. Purdue Pitt was an outstanding game. North Carolina Maryland was a great game. That was high-level hoops at 20 paces last night at Chapel Hill before North Carolina finally put on a little burst at home and won it. So to their credit, big win for North Carolina last night. Got Page back in the lineup, and he played really well. Melo Trimble played well last night. He had 20-plus points, a dozen assists, but he also had, I think, 8 or 9 turnovers in the game. And the challenge is underway. Indiana plays Duke tonight. Ohio State's lost 4 in a row. So we'll talk about David Price in a little bit because, obviously, we're here in Boston. It's amazing. Ben Cherington would not pull the trigger on the Cole Hamels trade. They had it all set. He wouldn't do it. And now Dave Dombrowski is the general manager, and they go out and they sign David Price. We'll talk about that in a minute. We've also been talking about the Tax Slayer Bowl putting out their tweet today. Who would you like to see in the game, Georgia versus Penn State or LSU versus Penn State? There were no other options. In reality, there is another option. That is Florida State. Florida State is, if they have their druthers, their number one selection. If Clemson wins the ACC championship, that probably takes Florida State out of the Jacksonville mix and opens the door wide for Penn State. If North Carolina wins the game, then Clemson probably goes to the Peach Bowl in Atlanta, and it knocks Florida State down the ladder in the ACC, and Jacksonville might be the option. And Florida State is their number one pick. Fair enough?
Hang on, I'm drawing a roadmap.
That's pretty simple. If Clemson wins, I think Penn State's going to Jacksonville. If North Carolina wins, Penn State has to go someplace else.
It's the someplace else that I need the roadmap for.
Well, it's either Nashville or it's Santa Clara.
Santa Clara is a little warmer than Nashville, isn't it?
Yeah, they're about the same. All right, Neil Coulon coming up as to whether they found Antonio Brown or not. Last we saw, the only guy I saw in the picture was number 25 for Seattle.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Great to have you with us. We're here in Boston today. The Big Ten ACC Challenge, Penn State and Boston College tonight, 7:15 with a 6:30 airtime. As Penn State plays BC tonight in the ACC Challenge, two young teams, with the exception of Eli Carter, who's a fifth-year player who's playing for his third team. He started his career at Rutgers. He then played 2 years at Florida. He's now at Boston College. Wow. There's some NBA guys that have been with fewer teams. But he's their leading scorer. He's also averages 17 shots a game. Time now for this day in sports history. And in 1963, the Major League Baseball Rules Committee banned the use of oversized catcher's mitts. The rule went into effect in 65. Now, of course, with knuckleball pitchers, you do need a bigger mitt. 1984, Dan Marino threw his 40th touchdown pass of the season. He ended up throwing 48 that year. 1988, ESPN aired its 10,000th Sports Center, making it the most televised cable program in history. In 1997, Latrell Sprewell's $32 million contract was terminated by the Golden State Warriors. The termination came one day after Sprewell assaulted head coach P.J. Carlissimo. Obviously, a $32 million contract is a huge reason to have anger issues. Okay. Kevin, have you been able to find Antonio Brown? He seemed to be missing on Sunday. I thought he was the number one guy.
Well, you know, you got a lot of good guys to choose from on that receiving corps. So, you know, you have to spread the ball around a little bit. Listen, I'm not worried about the receiving corps. I'm worried about the defensive corps.
Your guy was MIA on Sunday.
So was the defense.
Okay. Richard Sherman, we can now declare, is better. All day. All day. Let's bring in Neil Coulong, who covers the Steelers. Neil, welcome. Great to have you with us. Ben Roethlisberger, concussion protocol. What are his odds of getting out of it and playing on Sunday?
Well, according to him, this morning again, now he says he did pass the test. He is scheduled to practice today. So if you want to go on his word again, I mean, he said the same thing on Tuesday. So he says he's practicing. I guess really now it's just kind of a wait-and-see situation. If he is out on the field in practice, I think, barring any other setbacks, he's going to play on Sunday. But, it seems to be some discourse within the team, and it's stuff that Roethlisberger doesn't seem real happy about. So I don't think that's the last we've heard of this story, that the union's getting involved as well. It just kind of seems to be a something that's getting trumped up for all the wrong reasons here. I mean, it's something that you hope they would just handle internally, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
Why the discourse?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think in knowing it, Coach Tomlin, one of his big things is he doesn't want players going around talking about injuries. And the fact that Ben did on his radio show right before Tomlin's press conference yesterday, I would imagine, didn't sit well with him. And there was a little bit of a bite to Tomlin's comment that he said, regardless of how they feel, whether they feel good or not, something to that effect. It was aimed, it seemed to me anyway, to be aimed specifically at Roethlisberger's comments from earlier. To me, knowing that, it wasn't at all a surprise that it leaked out afterwards that he actually failed the test and was still in protocol. That came out not long after the press conference. So it seems like there's kind of that internal battle over who's allowed to speak about what. And some of it, in my opinion anyway, comes down to image. I mean, the Steelers, especially with the movie that just came out and the fact that one of their larger sponsors is UPMC, which is what Olamu, the doctor in that Will Smith movie, who he works for. They have because of that, kind of a social obligation to make sure that they are above the line in everything that they do as far as concussions go. They would rather, I would think anyway, just from an image perspective, they would rather it seem like they're going to wait until they absolutely have to make a decision to say that they've gone through everything that they need to go through for Roethlisberger, and they don't want him coming out saying that he's ready to go on Tuesday before the team had a chance to respond to all of it.
Okay, so now let's get to Antonio Brown. How good, in your opinion, is Richard Sherman? I know he's a physical corner out there, but what does it tell you about Sherman versus Antonio Brown based on what we saw last week?
I definitely think they're two of the best, if not the best, in the game at their respective positions. And for Sherman to do what he did, largely eliminating Antonio Brown from that game. I mean, he had 12 targets and only six catches. That's quite a hefty number. And Brown still was able to get six catches, 50 yards. I mean, it's not a great game, certainly not by Brown standards, but you have to think he's making an impact putting up those kinds of statistics. Sherman, in my mind, is the best. I mean, I think from a physical standpoint, he has ideal length for his position. It makes it so hard to get balls over his head. It makes it hard to throw stuff low in front of him. And he's an excellent mirror cornerback. I mean, really, you watch him play, you watch his technique. Nobody in the game, in my opinion, does it better than him. I'm not at all surprised that Brown was limited the way that he was. And I would say that, Sherman got the better of him in that game. But, it looked a little bit of clutch and grab going on down the field on his interception. So who knows? He doesn't grab onto him. Maybe Brown makes that play. All of a sudden he's at, 80, 90 yards with that big play on him, and Sherman doesn't have an interception. That goes Brown's way. So I think it was definitely a very combative matchup, and one that, as a football fan, I really enjoyed. I thought it was great.
Yeah, it was great to watch because you saw two of the best head-to-head, and Sherman obviously won it by a wide margin. What about the defense, though, for the Steelers? I know Russell Wilson's a fine quarterback, But that's not exactly Jerry Rice and John Taylor running out there at wide receiver. He threw five touchdown passes. What did you think of the Steelers' defensive performance?
The Steelers lost by a wide margin when it comes to defensive football in that game. Oh, man, they got out-schemed badly. The secondary really just didn't look prepared in terms of coverage. And Seattle did not do anything differently in that game than they have all season. I was really surprised with what seemed to be a lack of preparation, a lack of execution on their part. More than anything, though, it's like if you want to get beat on, you know, a 12-yard curl route, all right, I can understand the difficulty of completing, you know, seven of those to get down the field. But for the fact that continued to happen deep into the fourth quarter, and then the abysmal level of tackling that the Steelers had was well, I guess I really shouldn't even be surprised by it. They're not a good tackling defense. They haven't been all year, and they've got real problems in their secondary. Seattle did a great job of putting their receivers in position to make plays. And, yeah, you're right. They're not Jerry Rice. They have some speed, but they should not have been able to run free over the Steelers secondary the way that they did. Really just a bad beat in that regard. And you can't rack up 538 yards of offense and lose like that. You just can't. Very, very tough game for the Steelers to take.
Yeah, there's no question about it. It was across the board. I never did hear the explanation about the Landry Jones play where he tried to throw the wheel route on the field goal deal. What was the explanation behind that?
Tomlin really didn't say, and that shouldn't be a surprise to anybody who follows the Steelers. He's not going to get into specifics about those kinds of things. He left it very general. He made the call. He owns responsibility for it. That's really about it. But what we did hear is a couple times at least that they had practiced the play. I thought it was interesting that the amount of players who mentioned that after the game. It's, you know, we ran this better before. It looked better in practice than it did. In other words, we know how bad this was. What I thought was interesting, Ramon Foster mentioned something about the possibility in some cases of jumping off sides or, you know, intentionally committing a false start if you know that that's going to be bad. But it's not something that they can do. It's not something they're going to do. And Tomlin had confirmed at his press conference that Landry Jones wasn't allowed to call timeout in that situation. So it really, in my mind, there was a string of mistakes. Calling the play in the first place, I don't think it was a good idea for the down and distance in the position of the game. On top of that, and I apologize for the semi-truck driving behind me here, then you had the fact that you had a break in between when the play was originally going to be called, in which case I could see, you know, the Steelers knowing that they can just, you know, wait until the first quarter ends if they don't like what they saw and then either kick the field goal or go for it with your offense. They kept the same personnel out on the field. There's absolutely no way Seattle did not know exactly what they were doing, and they lined up perfectly. You're not playing the Cleveland Browns defense. I mean, Seattle knows what they're doing. It's an experienced group, and it's a talented group. To continue with the play at that point, in my mind, is mind-boggling. It was a ridiculously poor decision. And then on top of it, you had a terrible throw, which I don't know how you couldn't have expected Landry Jones to have a pretty, you know, high probability of that, considering he's coming off the bench in a 42-degree day, and he's Landry Jones. I mean, I don't know what you expect to get, especially when you're running a wheel route with your left tackle. On top of that, Stephon Tuitt and Cam Hayward were both running routes, the Steelers starting defensive ends. I don't know what possessed them to think that kind of a play was going to work. But if it ever would work, it's not going to be against a defense like Seattle's after Jones is staring down the defense for 5 seconds in that formation. There's just no way that's going to play. My immediate thought after it, one, was it's the worst call I think I've ever seen the Steelers make. And two, we used to do stuff like that, like toward the end of the football season. You know, when you play backwards ball, basically you have your offensive lineman playing running back and quarterback and things like that. That's what that play looked like to me. And usually you laugh about it, but that was just a disaster.
Neil, unfortunately, I find your answer too logical.
I have a problem with that.
The way you laid it out, offensive linemen weren't running wheel routes, defensive nose tackles. The way you laid it out, I'm sorry, Neil.
You're not a coach. You can't look at that situation the way that it went down. And I understand hindsight's 2020. And sure, there are coaches that will gamble on things like that, and sometimes it pays off. The biggest thing I heard from people is, well, if it worked, we're geniuses. No. If it worked, you're lucky. There would have been no way for that play to have been successful outside of somebody slipping, falling down, getting unfortunately injured in some way. There's no way it was going to work. There's a cornerback sitting on top of the offensive lineman, who, by the way, everyone wants to say that he was a tight end in college. He wasn't Rob Gronkowski. He wasn't a pass-receiving tight end. He played in an option run-based offense as a tight end. In other words, he wasn't all that big, but he wasn't athletic enough to play receiver or anything like that. You can't have him catching passes. And he's split out wide a couple times this season. I really don't get why it is with the depth that they have at receiver, with Ben Roethlisberger as their quarterback. I don't understand why in the world you put him on the bench to run a play, an actual play in a meaningful game. Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
All right. So right now the Steelers, if I read it right, Neil, they're on the outside looking in at this hour, correct?
Yes. Yes, they
are. All right. So take me down the stretch here of this schedule as to what you see down the stretch that opens the door for the Steelers to be in.
Well, I think, to me, what you really have to look at is two things. I mean, one, the Kansas City Chiefs are playing great football right now. I don't think anybody really saw that coming, but that's going to be a tough team to see, you know, falling apart and losing out down the stretch. I think they're in a prime position to take the 5 seed, and this, of course, can all change in the matter of a week. But they're playing great football, and they have been since they beat the Steelers at Arrowhead back in week 7. After that, you've got the Jets with a very shaky quarterback situation. You're not really sure what the quarterback situation for the Houston Texans is going to be. They fell apart in a similar situation last year around this time. The Buffalo Bills, I don't know how seriously you can take that team with their quarterback. So assuming Roethlisberger is healthy, I think in comparison to the other ones, you're asking him probably to win 3 of 5. And I don't think that's necessarily impossible for them, considering, I mean, you've got just a battered and beaten Ravens team in week 16. You've got the Cleveland Browns in week 17, and I don't think that they've tried in week 17 in a decade. Denver is going to be a very tough team to beat, as is Cincinnati. And, you know, in my mind, then what this really comes down to is how well they can play against Indianapolis, a team that, you know, they should factor in as well within the playoff run. I mean, they're tied now with Houston for the AFC South lead. They're in a real tough spot. I mean, it's hard to project. It's hard for me where I sit right now to say yes or no. But they're going to earn however it is they finish this year. The situation is there for them to either take this or to fumble it, to pardon the expression. I think they should be able to pull it out, but the way this year has gone for them, I don't know. It's tough to feel optimistic.
Yeah, part of this is that New England will determine part of this, too. New England has Houston, I think, a week from Sunday night. That game was flexed. It'll be Bill O'Brien's first meeting against his old head coach, Bill Belichick. Houston still has New England to play, among other teams, but again, they have their division schedule's weaker.
Yeah, that's definitely a valid argument. And, you know, it's the thing with O'Brien teams, you know, you want to keep, at least the last 2 years that I've really followed him, you want to always keep the door open, because you never are quite sure if this team is going to put everything together and, you know, utilize the talent that they have. They're capable of doing it, and they've done it. I mean, that Cincinnati game was, you know, nearly flawless from their perspective for needing to do what they did. Playing at Cincinnati, an undefeated team on Monday night, that's a tough game to win. And they went in, they played their butts off. You have to be worried about that, you know, from that perspective. And anytime you put a guy like J.J. Watt on the field, you can't feel real good about your chances. You know, defensive ends get paid the most in the NFL behind quarterbacks for that exact reason. They're the guys that can stop quarterbacks. So you think that, you know, J.J. Watt can, you know, put up that MVP-like performance again for 5 weeks. You know, it's tough to bet against them, too.
I'll ask you one final question, Neil. I'll let you go. You mentioned defensive ends get the number two money behind quarterbacks. How have you felt about the play of Bud Dupree, who was the Steelers' number one pick?
He's been up and down. I think he's been a rookie. What the Steelers really wanted to do this year, I think, above anything else, was get a rotation going, an outside linebacker. I think we saw last year. In fact, I remember talking to you about this last year, several times, in which Jason World looked completely exhausted. James Harrison, being 37 years old, drug out of you know, semi-retirement to get back on the field and play 40 snaps the next week. He was gassed at the end of the Tampa Bay game. They could have had a shot at a playoff bye in the first round had they had rested pass rushers in late in games, and they just got killed because of it. So I don't think that Dupree is necessarily to a point where you can say this guy's a bona fide starter. It probably, you know, might not even be a role player a year ago or 2 years ago, and not because of talent, but just more because of scheme. They wanted to change that from a conditioning standpoint, and get rested guys on the field. With that, you've seen him come off the edge, and he explodes. I mean, the guy is just a phenomenal athlete. Real thoroughbred, but there are times in which, you know, if he's not able to beat the tackle straight off the line with a rush, he gets blocked and he stays blocked. You know, he's got a lot of work to do with his hands. He's not quickly, you know, transferring that speed to power. In other words, when he gets into the tackle, he's not able to disengage himself. It's very similar to, you know, he kind of looks like a faster Jarvis Jones to me right now. I'm not sure that's exactly a compliment, but, you know, the arrow is pointing up for him, I think, as Coach Tomlin would say. He's just got a lot of work to do, and I think they knew that when they selected him. And I don't necessarily think he's playing because he's earned it. I think they need to get rested guys out there and try to protect that pass rushing group as much as they can.
Neil, absolute pleasure. Thanks so much. Appreciate your time.
Definitely. Thanks for having me.
Neil Coulong joining us, covers the Pittsburgh Steelers, and he hasn't found Antonio Brown either. We'll come back with more in a moment. We'll continue to have, in fact, we'll have Kevin set up the bowl picture, because he'll do it in such a way where all of you think we're going to Guadalajara on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
This year marks Sunbury Motor Company's 100th year in business, and we will be keeping the same tried and true values we've had ever since we opened our doors, guaranteeing your car buying experience will be smooth and hassle-free. No spinning a wheel for specials you don't need or want. No pushy sales staff pouncing on you as soon as you arrive. No sideshow yelling. Since we began back in 1915, we have strived to be your most trusted friend when it comes to all of your new car needs, whether that's in sales or service. We strive to offer you as many viable options as we possibly can. Sunbury Motor Company always carries a line of few other options auto dealers in our area can compete with. With our inventory of Ford, Hyundai, Kia, and Lincoln vehicles, there should be no problems with finding the right vehicle to fit your needs. Our friendly and trustworthy staff is knowledgeable in all of our products and stand ready to answer all of your questions and meet all of your needs. In honor of 100 years in business, SMC is introducing the all-new Auto Club, where Sunbury Motors will pay you for every mile you drive. Be sure to ask us about our Auto Club benefits. Sunbury Motors in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza and at sunburymotors.com, proudly owned by the Mertz family since 1915.
All right, the Taxslayer Bowl, to their credit, has kind of laid their cards out on the table for everybody, and they've really made it, at least they've laid the cards out. The Rose Bowl, for example, says, oh, by the way, they may not take the loser of Michigan State, Iowa. They may take Ohio State instead. They're obligated to take a Big Ten team, but they're not obligated to take the loser of the game. If Ohio State ends up ranked higher than the loser of the Michigan State-Iowa game, they might opt for Ohio State in the Rose Bowl. As for the Taxslayer Bowl, Florida State's their number one choice, but if Clemson beats North Carolina, Florida State may be in line to go to the Peach Bowl as part of the New Year's Six. And that opens the door for Penn State to play either LSU or Georgia. All right? So that's where it stands. Kevin will explain all of it to you and how Penn State could possibly be playing in Guadalajara based on his roadmap.
All maps lead to somewhere sunny.
I hope so.